Let me pray. Father, thank you for another morning to be with you and your people and to enter into your word and to think about what you do as the sovereign God through the nations that you rule over. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen. How familiar are you with the formation of the United States government? Does anybody know what happened on this date in history, from this week, September 17th? Does anybody know?
I don't know. Chester A. Arthur became president?
Nope. The United States Constitution was signed and ratified on September 17th, 1788. What did we have before the Constitution? The Articles of Confederation. Some people took their civics class and remember. It was signed March 1st, 1781 in Maryland. That was the first state to sign it and put it into effect was Maryland. Yep. The Declaration of Independence, when was that signed? Now this 4th of July. Yes. That's why we celebrate the 4th of July. And the 1776. Yes. The Bill of Rights. Would the Constitution have been signed and put into effect if there was no plan for a Bill of Rights?
No.
Yes, this was very important. A number of states and the representatives would only sign it if a Bill of Rights was coming down the pike. So that was passed by Congress on September 25th, 1789. Who was the first president?
George Washington.
Of what?
United States of America.
Under the Constitution.
Of America.
But did you know that John Hanson was the first president?
No.
Under the Articles of Confederation. And then we actually had 8 presidents before George Washington under those articles. Elias Boudinot, Thomas Mifflin, Richard Henry Lee, you should probably recognize this name, John Hancock. You know your Hancock. Nathaniel Gorham, Arthur St. Clair, and Cyrus Griffin all came before George Washington. It was 1 year. It was a 1 year term. There was no executive branch. John Hanson actually got a lot done. It was very important in the establishment of our country. You can imagine that first president under the Articles of Confederation. What's your guess in terms of how long our Constitution has been around? What? So 200 and almost 50 years, right? Did I do that math right? Almost. Coming up, almost. Coming up on 250 years, all right? Exactly 248, says the engineer. What is the average length of a constitution worldwide since 1776? Because ours was one of the first.
20.
Okay, guy says 20. Correct. 17 years is the average length that a constitution lasts in the world. Ours is almost 250 years old. That's pretty remarkable. All right. Well, how has civil government developed since the beginning of time? We thought a little bit about our country. What about since the beginning of time? That's the question we want to think about this morning. Why did civil government develop? Here's the answer. Since sin spreads and self-governance repeatedly fails, God established civil government as mankind multiplied. So we're going to walk from creation onwards. So we start at creation. These are things we've covered before and things that we know. God is the sovereign. He's the creator. And he's involved with the preservation of the universe. He sustains the creation. We looked at some of those passages a few weeks ago. His providence is also in play. He's the supreme governor ruling over the creation through his appointed mediators. You start with Adam, who was a husband and father. You could say he was the king. He was the royal male leader. Adam was also a spiritual leader. He was not only king, he was prophet and priest. You have the first family in Adam and Eve. So John Frame says, so the family is the basic unit of human society. He's talking about an earlier chapter when he said, all the institutions of society, prophetic, priestly, and kingly, begin in the family. To children, parents are rulers, educators, providers, and evangelists. All other forms of authority are extended forms of fatherhood and motherhood. So historically, developmentally, and logically, the family is, as I said in the previous chapter, and of course you haven't read that, but the fundamental sphere from which all others are derived. Honor in all spheres is derived from parental honor. Hopefully, we've been hitting this point over and over again. It should make sense to you. When God says, honor your father and mother in the fifth commandment, this is the root, this is the source, the place where honor begins. And as Frame is saying, everything else works out from the family. Well, so there's Adam and Eve. They're supposed to be self-governed. Eat all of this food, except for the fruit from this one tree. Be self-governed. And they didn't exercise self-governance. They were also to mediate governance over creation, the dominion mandate. Culture should arise from them. You see this shortly after in Genesis chapter 4. Right? Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name is Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. You see the development of vocation, of economic industry, the development of culture in the individual and the family. But, yes. Yep.
Not yep. a very fine pedigree.
Nope. Yeah. Multiplication of families necessitates some restraint, some sort of order, some sort of law. Put two neighbors next to each other. Whose land is whose land? Whose property is whose property? Can I just come in your house and drink your milk or not? I remember in Andy Nassella's book on conscience, I can't remember the other guy's name, but he was a missionary overseas. He was appalled when his neighbors would come and pluck fruit from his tree. Because in America, that's not what we do. Right? Your tree is your tree. You have to ask permission or you would share. But in that culture, it was just common. If there was a tree in your yard, people just came by and pulled the fruit off of it. There's to be some sort of governance, expectations and standards regarding life and liberty and property of each household. Well, that's creation. We move then into the fall. And you'd say biblical revelation about the fall is largely focused on the curse that comes upon both Adam and Eve's vocation, Adam in tending the garden, Eve in nurturing children. It's on the family and upon their vocation. But what we see unfold from chapter 3 in the following chapters is this. Because of the fall and the entrance of sin into mankind, wickedness and evil expanded. Therefore, restraint was necessary for social order. So we're going to look at Cain and Abel. The need for restraint in the face of anger. That's one thing we see here. Need for restraint in the face of anger. Would someone like to read Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 16?
Yeah. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offspring, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it." Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden.
Thanks, Andy. Verse 9, the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" The word keeper there is the exact same word that God uses back in the garden. When he tells the man, and when took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. He's saying, Cain, you're supposed to do the same thing I told your father to do. Keep, guard, keep watch. Look over this. Govern yourself, right? Don't let sin rule over you. Cain fails, and he commits murder, right? He ends the life of another image bearer, which is very clear to us from the creation account, the importance of the image-bearing nature of man and woman. And Cain is being, I would say, a bit sarcastic when he says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" But here's this witness, Abel's blood on the ground, crying out that he's been murdered. And you see, God, as the sovereign king, is the one who comes and issues justice. There's nobody else there present to stand as a judge. Although you have to wonder where Adam was and where Eve was. And God issued judgment and punishment, right? He cursed Cain's labor. He made him a wandering fugitive. And yet you also see that he put restraint on evil. He restrains others from doing to Cain and seeking vengeance and justice. There's a restraint needed in the face of anger. And then we get to Lamech. We heard a little bit about his offspring. But we hear this in verses 19 to 24. Lamech took two wives. You go, well, that's a problem. We just heard something else about one man and one woman coming together and making one flesh. The name of the one was Ada and the name of the other Zillah. Ada bore Jabal. We've just read this. His offspring are producing culture, going to work. And then Lamech said to his wives, "Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. So here's Lamech, and what is he doing? Well, he violates the marriage covenant, first of all, between one man and one woman. So he's not self-governing himself. So there's not restraint on God's created design and good order for one man and one woman to come together. And then he murders a man who struck him. Doesn't sound like self-defense, right? Wasn't defending himself from an attack. the justice that he thought he could bear out was not due punishment for the perceived, I'm going to say perceived because I don't know, given the sense we get of Lamech, the perceived slight that he received. Maybe he was struck by a young man. So he's taking justice into his own hands.
Well, he's actually expanding vengeance over justice. Right? Justice would be an in-kind. I mean, that's the whole purpose. The whole purpose behind an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And, I mean, he's illustrated a principle of escalation, which means, you know, for every evil, then there's more evil.
Greater. Yes.
That comes after that. You know?
Yeah. I appreciate the clarity that brings. This is vengeance. This is injustice. It's not true justice. Yeah. Yep. But there's a lack of self-governance, and you could say more individualism, and absolute individualism is anarchy. That's what we see spreading here. Man doing what he wants. So there's a need for civil government in the face of unrestrained lust. That'd be the second thing on your outline there. So we saw anger, now we're looking at unrestrained lust. There's also a need for restraint in the face of just widespread unrighteousness. The story keeps going, and we get to Genesis chapter 6. Someone like to read Genesis 6, 1 through 8.
When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. Is that it?
But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Yeah. So regardless of your take on what exactly is happening here between these sons and these daughters and whether you believe there's angelic beings or whether you believe these are different lines of mankind, regardless of your opinion, you know that what's wrong is this taking of wives and the offspring that is produced. There's something wrong with the type of marriage or maybe polygamous marriage or immorality outside of marriage going on here. So again, we see the breaking, we see unrestrained lust breaking the basic covenant basic creation of marriage. And then we hear the Lord is going to issue judgment because there's such great wickedness. You know, we look around and we see awful things happening. But would we look around and would we be able to say what the Lord says here? Every intention of the thoughts of every human's heart was only evil continually, except for one man. Except for one man. Wickedness is unrestrained here. So God issues judgment. He sends a flood. We move forward in the story to after the flood in Genesis chapter 9. And there God is talking to Noah, Genesis chapter 9. And he says, we hear this. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. He says, "In you, be fruitful and multiply. Increase greatly on the earth and multiply it." Guy was talking about earlier that justice really is punishment due to the nature and degree and type of the crime. That's what we see God communicating here. Punishment due for the crime of murder, shedding the blood of an image bearer, is like in kind. You will also die. Your life will be taken. If we were to go to Exodus chapter 20 to 24, there we see the giving of the old covenant. I'll just describe some things there. We've got laws about marriage in there, restitution, justice, and extensions of the fifth commandment of murder. And we hear things like, "Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. You shall take him from my altar that he may die." Talks about striking a father or mother, stealing, cursing, men who are quarreling and striking one another, what happens to them. Striking slaves, striking animals, hitting pregnant women, and what happens to them. That's where we hear, "But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." Even an animal. If your ox is given to goring others, and you don't rein it in, that ox can be put to death. Let's ask a question here. Is the responsibility for administering justice given to a single man, Noah, to the family, Noah and his wife and his children, or to the civil government? I would agree. Yes. Christians diverge here. So is it the family, is it individual, family, mankind? So some who would propose that it's the family who administers justice. John Frame is one of those. And he would look to, okay, so you see God giving this instruction to Noah here in Genesis 9. But then later on in the Mosaic Law, you hear about the avenger of the blood, right? And who is the avenger of the blood? Does anybody remember? What's their relationship to the one who is murdered? A kinsman. Yeah, it's somebody within your family. So some Christians would argue, okay, we see then in the law, those who are able to issue the justice due for murder has to be a kinsman, somebody in the family.
Is this a plug for the Hatfields and McCoys?
They probably worked it out that way, didn't they? Yeah, but that, you can see that's the argument made as to why they would say that. I would counter and say, as Guy said, you know, we're looking here at an individual, a family, and all of the nations in one man and his family. They're all there in one, just like we were all represented in Adam when he was here. He was our covenant head. Our God is a covenant God. We are a covenant people. This is how the world works. We get represented by others, even if we're not there. But even then, you look at Genesis 9, "For your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it. And from man," that's Adam, "from man, Ish, his brother, I will require a reckoning for the life of man." If you literally translate what is said there, it is from man, his brother, which could mean man, his kinsman. His kinsman must do this. That his brother, though, could be more expanded than just, "I have a younger brother who's 2 years younger than me," right? It could be, "You are my kinsmen in Christ, my brothers." It might be in my community, my extended cousins. But if we were all Israelites, we would all be kinsmen together. Verse 6, though, says as well, "Whoever sheds the blood of man," that's Adam, "by man, Adam, shall his blood be shed." It doesn't make that distinction. It's broad, any mankind. Also, I read what some of those laws in Exodus 21, where you hear, "Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. You shall take him from my altar that he may die." You do this. There's not specificity of your kinsman avenger of the blood must come and do this. He was speaking to the congregation of all Israel to do this. Most Christians take this as mankind administers justice. This is after the flood, Noah and his posterity equals all mankind. We see the covenant reestablished here, what we call the Noahic covenant. Strong parallels to the creation and dominion account right after that, right? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. And it's pre-Abraham and pre-Israel. So it's not restricted to the Mosaic covenant era. Yeah, go ahead.
I think if you look at what Jesus says about retribution, you heard it said in Matthew 2:2, it would suggest that this isn't required of the individual that they exact retribution. So that would make you think it's more.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was expanding on the law, he wasn't deleting it. So that meant that that wasn't in conflict with the law.
So Wayne Grudem says, God established the obligation for human beings to carry out the most severe punishment, the taking of a human life, in retribution for the most horrible crime, the murder of another human being. Once this principle was established, then the imposition of lesser penalties for lesser crimes was also validated. Since a government has the right to carry out the most severe punishment, certainly has the right to carry out lesser punishments for lesser crimes as well. Let's pause here and you guys can grapple with the question. Do you think this was the individual, the family, the civil government? Does this apply to all mankind for all time? Wrestle with some of those questions and talk with the people at your table. So, what conclusion did you all come to? This table back there, they all agreed that Genesis 9 was the establishment of civil government, of a civil government's responsibility to bear justice. This is for all mankind. What are the other two tables? What did you guys come to? What conclusion?
The same
conclusion.
It has to do with the authority that you have over the person being judged.
Yes.
If you don't have authority over them, you don't judge them.
Yes, which is a good point to make. If I'm a father, I have authority over three human beings. I do not have authority over anyone else's children. That's right? That's a good thing. I'm a pastor. I have authority over the sheep of this congregation. If I don't have authority to issue justice in Zimbabwe, I shouldn't be issuing justice in Zimbabwe, right? Yeah, so that's a good point to make. Gary DeMar makes this comment. He says, as sin increased, so did the development of civil government. Since man would not govern himself, and his lack of self-government jeopardized the property and lives of others, God instituted specific government requirements. Human governments were required by God to punish crimes that threatened life, liberty, and property.
So big government is good.
No. No hesitation here on that one. We are all decentralized. Little government, all right? We'll talk about this later when we get to biblical principles for government. All right, so Genesis 9 happens. Genesis 10, we see the table of nations. We're looking at post-flood development of what we might call familial clans and nations, and we see the table of nations. Here you see awareness of different peoples, all descended from Noah, but developing familial distinctions. You see phrases like, each with his own language, by their clans, in their nations. These are the sons of Ham, by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the clans of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies in their nations and from these nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Now here I'm quoting from a gentleman talking about the Table of Nations. He says, what is the purpose of the Table of Nations? And he references Waltke and Hamilton, their Old Testament scholars, who both note that this Table of Nations is unique among ancient Near East literature. What's unique about it? The purpose must be to show that God is not a provincial deity who only reigns over some local territory. That was what you saw in ancient Near East civilizations. There was a God, he was over this area, this territory, this land. Rather, the God of the Bible is the universal and sovereign God who rules and reigns over all his creation. That's what you're seeing in the Table of Nations, these 70 nations that are spoken of. And this sets the scene for, as you could guess, more wickedness. Genesis chapter 11, we see the Tower of Babel. And here we really see the development of distinct ethnos, distinct nations, from one united mankind to distinguished groups and clans of peoples. You have this tyrant Nimrod centralizing big government in Babel with a slave worker program. Build this tower up to the heavens. And God comes down and issues judgment. And he does it by making them speak Babel, gibberish. They can't understand each other. That's a bad idea when there are hammers involved and nails. I imagine there were a few injuries that day. And so their languages forced them to separate. Right. So you begin to see more distinct ethnos nations develop. Geographical borders. These people here, these people over here. That, of course, limits your marriage partners and who you might marry. Different religious and political and economic cultural expressions arise. Anybody who's seen two children fight over geographical region of a playroom know that nations will fight over geographical regions and their resources in those areas. Competition, rivalry. Then we move into Genesis 12 and the patriarchal era. Here we see an authority structure built around the extended family. So you have a patriarch at the head of a people. He and his children and then his grandchildren. He's the senior patriarch over him, right? We have Abraham, even with Lot, his extended kinsman who comes and lives with him. See Isaac and Jacob. Job is probably in the patriarchal era. Gary DeMar says that there were family, regional, and national governments during the time of the patriarchs. Each of these groups was a relatively autonomous governing body, free from the potential despotic rule of other families and clans. These groups were probably aware of each other. There were standards set and acknowledged, and you transgress the boundaries of their laws and there'll be due punishment. You see the challenge of property even within a clan, right? Abraham and Lot are seeking to settle after coming out of, they go down to Egypt and then they're coming back up near Sodom and Gomorrah. They're trying to settle land on which side of the mountain and not. There's a dispute over property because their flocks are growing in such size. And during this era, we see a couple of things. We see the emergence of nations with more developed government. Yeah, so Abram did go down to Egypt. Notice that there was a pharaoh over Egypt and his sons, the princes. So you see this establishment of a ruling class in Egypt. We also see independent city-states like Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham settled in the land of Canaan while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. In Genesis 14, you see that there are kings ruling all over these city-states. Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elisar. Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim. And they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and Birsha, king of Gomorrah, and Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. Right, we might think of Greek city-states like Athens or Sparta or Thebes, these city-states. Well, there were city-states in this time as well. We see the development of international affairs. You've got defense treaties going on in Genesis chapter 14. You've got trained family armies. Abraham had just men ready to call. They were prepared for war, which suggests that this was a thing that was happening. It wasn't like he was just a super anxious guy and waiting for the war to happen. I think this was just a regular pattern of life at that time. And you see alliances between these city-states, nations, and you see war between them. That's the patriarchal era. And from them comes Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They go down into Egypt, and they become too numerous to be merely patriarchal. Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. You see the 12 tribes. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. I have a hard time ruling 3 persons. Can you imagine being a patriarch ruling 70 persons? It gets more complicated. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them. Then there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to the people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from Israel." And you see the development of clans, heads of clans within the 12 tribes. You know, from then on, we're going to see many references to the tribes represented by whoever the clan head is at that time in history. Well, God, of course, redeems his people. He brings them out of slavery, out of Egypt under that oppressive king. And he leads them into the wilderness. Maybe you remember Exodus chapter 18, where what was the problem Moses was facing as he is the judge? It's too many things. Yeah, so what does his father-in-law Jethro come and advise? Delegate, yep. Raise up other judges. You're the Supreme Court, if you will. These are other regional court judges underneath you. So here we see the establishment of a hierarchical court system. Judges over thousands and hundreds and fifties. We also begin to see the development of the priesthood. Right? The Levites are led by Aaron, the brother of Moses. Moses is a prophet king, but now the priests are starting to develop their own arm, their own office. John Frame captures it this way. The picture to this point then is that as Israel developed from nuclear family to extended family to clan to nation, family authority became more elaborate and complicated. So in time, God introduced new institutions. The heads of extended families were no longer exclusively responsible for prophetic and priestly ministries, as were the patriarchs. Rather, God relieved them by assigning many religious duties to priests, Levites, prophets. So Israel's in the wilderness. And then we see God issuing his covenant with them. Exodus 19 and on. They enter into relationship with God as their governor. Exodus 20, we see the giving of the Ten Commandments there. You could say this covenant and the law is their constitution. That's the ground and idea for why many of our founding fathers wanted to establish a constitution. They knew the Bible. They saw this constitution-like document in Exodus and wanted to do something in kind. you see here, there's a consent of the people. It's not just God issuing forth, here's the law and what I expect. The people respond. They consent to this. Exodus chapter 19. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. Notice he calls the elders of the people. He calls representatives of the people. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you, may also believe you forever." So God's the lawgiver. He's redeemed them. He's therefore their lawgiver. He makes a covenant with them. He's made the sign of the covenant. There were stipulations then, laws in effect. If you kept those laws, you would be blessed. If you don't keep those laws, you're going to be cursed. And God offers his promises to his people. There's even regulations for foreigners and strangers who might find themselves among the people of Israel. So Israel as a nation is developing. Let's see if I can finish this. Israel goes into the land in the time of Judges. We see that. And what do we hear in the time of Judges? Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. Back to that self-governance failure. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Judges 17:6. At the beginning of Judges, we see this. Judges 2, and all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. A couple of verses later, when they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. Now God makes his promise that he's going to send them little saviors, little d deliverers over and over again, and that's what he does. We saw that when we were in the book of Judges several years ago. So Israel's in the land. They keep in this cycle of experiencing oppression, God's deliverance, oppression, God's deliverance. They have judges. We get to Samuel, and they want a king. Give us a king, God. We see that in 1 Samuel 8. "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways." They're talking to Samuel. He's the prophet. "Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." All the good things that God had done for them, and they rejected him as their king. If you go back to Deuteronomy 17, you see there's provision for a king. God said, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you and you possess it and dwell in it and then say, "I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me," you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. "One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you, not a foreigner. And this king must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to go back to Egypt. The Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. It shall be with him. He shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and he may not turn from the commandment." God made provision for a king for them, but They didn't want God as their king or the king that God would choose as his mediator. I think Gary DeMar is makes an astute observation here. He says, when the breakdown of society occurred, political power was seen as man's salvation. By changing man's surroundings through political means, it was believed that a better world could be created. The results of such an assumption led to tyranny and oppression. Theft, murder, and slavery were often used to usher in this better world. And those in position of power were not above confiscating property to gain even more prestige and authority, 1 Kings 21. When coercion did not work, murder was always an option. Some used murder to advance politically. Positions of power could be captured by eliminating the opposition, 2 Samuel chapter 3. Even the citizens were willing to give up their duties under God for the promises of salvation through the agency of the state, 1 Samuel 8. While civil government at all levels of society is necessary, city, county, state, and national, it must not usurp other legitimate governing authorities ordained by God. Israel wants a king. God gives them a king in Saul, and he's not a good king. God gives them a better king in David, but David has his faults as well. And then Solomon, and you see, just see the breakdown of the kings from there on. Well, this is the story of what unfolds as we look at the development of government. You see that there is a lack of self-governance, and there's a need for restraint on wickedness. And so this will help us as we move in next Sunday, as we will particularly look at Romans 13 and Peter, to think about what is the purpose of civil government. And that's where we will go next. I know we need to wrap up and transition, but any questions before we end today? Or any observations you'd like to share with the group? Okay. We're done. All right.